You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting.
Happy Thursday. Man, I don't know if you've been watching the coverage of asshole McCain's funeral, but it's so vomit-inducing. My favorite was when they showed a picture of Pedal Boy Biden wiping his eyes because he was so upset at the funeral. Oh, my buddy. We used to molest so many kids together. Who am I going to partner with now? I guess I'll have to call Obama. Holy shit, man. Is it so goddamn disgusting? I doubt it, but I would certainly hope that most people can see through that shit. My God, man. Are people around the country actually mourning the death of that raging piece of fucking horseshit? Anyway, we ran out of time yesterday. I started to tell a story. Not a big deal, but Paula, who called in at the last minute there, made me think of it. Speaking of hucksters at NASA, I was a freshman in high school. And, I was really interested in the Voyager missions, you know. So I wrote a letter to NASA headquarters asking them if they could send me. Actually, I included, I think the book was $8, including postage. NASA had printed, like mission summary reports, you know. And they were loaded with high gloss, National Geographic type glossy paper, with high grade photos. And so I wanted a copy of this report, So I wrote and said, yeah, I'm a freshman. I'm very interested in planetary astronomy, blah, blah, blah. Could I please get your report on the NASA? The Voyager mission, to Jupiter and, at the time, the Saturn report wasn't out yet because I think it was just before, I think it was 1981, early 81. Yeah, so it was before Voyager 2 supposedly passed Saturn. But the Jupiter report was completed. I think the last account was 1980, 79, and then 80. Anyway, so, I included the $8. I never heard from him. Never got the book, never heard from him. Some asshole pocketed the money. Not caring, and he was ripping off, a fucking freshman in high school. Unbelievable, man. And yet there they were, sucking billions of dollars out of taxpayers, as it was. Anyway. So those assholes still owe me, as if we should even have to pay for that, Our tax dollars supposedly pay for these, they do pay, but for these supposed missions, who the fuck knows what they're really doing with it, but think about it, guys. Your tax dollars are paying for this, and then on top of it, you have to turn around and pay for the report. Anybody who asks, who lives in this country, who's a citizen, who pays fucking taxes, as illegal as they are, you know, should have free access to that fucking information. Of course, now, you know, everything's on the net, but who knows what the hell it is you're actually getting anyway, to begin with, though. You know, this is a cause for doubt, too. If you ever look on NASA's official website for the Mars Science Rover, they update that thing like once every six fucking months. Are you shitting me? Are you fucking kidding me? Just for the hell of it, you know, every once in a while I'll go there and I'll check and I'm like, oh my God, 2 months, 3 months later, and they still have the same fucking pictures up. As far as the highlight images, you know, you supposedly can go into the archives itself and that updates daily, but you know, they're in black and white, they're shitty quality. But the, you know, the new fresh color images that they release like to the press, they don't update that damn thing, but once every fucking 6 months. And when they do update it, usually they only add one or two pictures and they're shitty pictures usually at that. They're not even that, you know, anything to get excited about. So you got to wonder. You got to wonder. Anyway, enough of that. I was quoting from the show ended off yesterday, you know, these astronauts that were being interviewed. The astronaut Don chimed in with this comment. You know, I was quoting back and forth what the different ones were saying. He said, there's more than stars. You can see planets. You can see moons. Now, wait just a minute, ladies and gentlemen. He's full of shit right there. This sounds like a fucking 10-year-old kid talking who knows nothing about astronomy, nothing about how the night sky looks. First of all, you can see stars and planets right here on the surface of good old planet Earth. You don't need to go into orbit to see that. Like I said, all you see when you're out in space is the stars are brighter, the planets are brighter and clearer, the sky, background sky is much darker, you know, because there's no atmosphere collecting and just and scattering light, you know, blah, blah, blah. But you're not going to see any more planets in orbit than what you see from Earth. You're going to see the same fucking planets. The only way you can see more is if you have a good pair of binoculars, you know, you can catch a glimpse of Neptune, perhaps, or Venus, you know, I mean, of Uranus, which is very difficult to see with the naked eye. Uranus, you can, but Neptune, no, you can't. Maybe out in orbit, you know, with a strong pair of binoculars, you might be able to faintly catch a little dot. But do note what he said here, though, at the end. You can see stars, you can see planets, you can see moons, he said. This guy is a fucking actor. He's not a real astronaut. He's not a trained scientist. He doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about. You cannot see moons, plural, in Earth orbit. By the way, you can go in low Earth orbit. You can go in high Earth orbit. You can even go out to the moon and orbit the moon, and you're still not going to see moons. The only moon you're going to see is our moon, which you don't have to go into orbit to see. You can see it right from the ground. Where does he get off saying you can see moons, plural? The only time you can see moons, plural, whether standing on the surface of the Earth or out in fucking orbit, is with a goddamn powerful telescope. The most easily visible moons are Jupiter's four Galilean satellites and Saturn's large moon Titan. You have to have, well, you don't even need a telescope, but you do need a strong pair of binoculars. You got to have at least 50x magnification. Other than that, you cannot see those moons. But why would he even point that out, that you can see moons? You know, he would probably defend himself. Oh, well, I could see him because I had a pair of binoculars. Big fucking deal. What does that mean to say that out in orbit, you can see moons? You can see those same fucking things if you've got a pair of binoculars from the surface of the Earth. Do you see what I'm saying? This is like a kid just making shit up who doesn't know what he's talking about, who isn't talking from experience. He's not even reading off the script sheet because,
anybody with half a fucking functioning neuron writing a script sheet would do a little homework and realize, oh, yeah, I'm not going to have him make a statement like that. That sounds stupid and childish, and it's going to give us away. He wasn't even reading a script. He was just making this fucking shit up. An untrained or very poorly trained fucking actor. This is not an astronaut, guys. No way. This is not somebody who actually was out in Earth orbit and is speaking from experience. What he would have said was, oh, the sky is beautiful from orbit. Much more stars, more clearly seen. I've never seen the Milky Way looking so beautiful. That would be someone who's been out in space. But to say you can see stars, planets, and moons, plural? Just like all the other bullshit that we're fed in the media, guys, statements like this appeal only to ignorant dumbasses. Anybody who's even mildly familiar with astronomy, who's actually observed the night sky with or without a telescope, even with the naked eye, you goddamn full well know that orbiting the Earth 100, 200 miles up isn't going to enable you to see any more fucking moons than our own moon. 200 miles is a drop in the bucket, baby. You are not going to see any more moons than our own moon. You can go to fucking Mars, and you're still not going to see Jupiter's moons with the naked eye. You'll see Mars's two moons, but you know what? You'd have to squint pretty goddamn hard to see the Earth's moon from Mars. Oh, the horse shit, man. It's unbelievable. Anyway. Another video on YouTube shows a female astronaut saying that when on the space station, astronauts simply swallow their toothpaste after brushing. Yet a male astronaut on another occasion in another video said that they spit their toothpaste out into a napkin and throw it away. Which is it? Which is it? There's a video of an alleged spacewalk of an astronaut whose helmet can be seen rotating from left to right. The problem is that astronaut helmets don't swivel. They are rigidly connected to the rest of the bodysuit so that internal pressurization can be better maintained. How in the hell could this helmet? Think about it, guys. That's fucking such nonsense. You have to maintain that air pressure or the astronaut will die. To have a loosely swiveling fucking, it's fucking unbelievable. And yet they broadcast this stuff on TV or they have it up on the internet for millions to see, and millions do see it and nobody bats an eyelash at it. We are being fucking bamboozled constantly with shit that should never fool intelligent thinking human beings. Unfortunately, they know all too well that most people have been so thoroughly and systematically dumbed fucking down that they're not intelligent or thinking human beings. Pretty shameful. Most of the people in this country today, guys, are they are goy. They're fucking cattle. Here are some major and blunderous admissions by some of NASA's scientists in recent years, very recent years, who are allegedly speaking from aboard the space station. One video clip shows a female in a blue suit and a male in a red suit. I don't know what their names are, but the man says, quote, right now, listen to this, right now we can only fly in Earth's orbit. That's the farthest we can go. We can only fly, and I'll add to that, and there's other astronauts later that, that add this word in as well. They can only fly in low Earth orbit. But did you catch the fact that he said only in Earth orbit? Obviously low Earth orbit, because again, they can't penetrate the fucking Van Allen radiation belts, right? But do understand that supposedly 50 some odd years ago, on six occasions, NASA sent astronauts to orbit the moon. How is it then, if we orbited the moon at least six times, that this guy is now saying 50 some odd years later that right now we can only fly in Earth orbit? That's the farthest we can go at this time. They want us to believe, once again, that 50 years ago with, Timex windable watch technology, we were able to pull off six trips to orbiting the moon, right? And landing on the moon. But now he's saying 50 years later, we still don't have the technology to go any further but orbiting the Earth and a low Earth orbit. Again, not more than 300 miles, because that's heading into the dangerous, deadly Van Allen belts. Can you fucking believe this, guys? Another clip showing two astronauts, again, a man and a woman, supposedly on the space station yet again, has the woman saying, quote, "The kinds of technology that we're testing out on the space station are definitely helping us with our goals of going beyond low Earth orbit." Holy fucking shit. Look these things up, guys, for yourself. I took this verbatim right off of these NASA videos. But, you know, if you want, request the notes, type these in a search engine, and you can watch for yourself. These statements were actually fucking made by supposed NASA astronauts, certainly speaking officially as NASA astronauts. So whether or not they're just actors, it doesn't matter. They're speaking as official NASA employees. And this is the kind of shit that fucking, can you believe this? You don't even have to examine the Apollo missions to see they're full of shit. Just look at these statements. These statements make Apollo impossible, guys. The kinds of technology that we're testing out on the space station are definitely helping us with our goals of going beyond low Earth orbit. That's their goal, to go beyond low Earth orbit. She's admitting they have not gone beyond low Earth orbit. They're working on it. It's a challenge. They're trying to conquer surmount that barrier. But right now, as of yet, they have not done it. So how the fuck did we go to the moon six times 50 some odd years ago? Can you fucking believe this? It's over right there, guys. The whole Apollo horseshit. These are statements that have been made in recent years. Another NASA scientist, I did get her name, Ellen Ochoa, recorded on NASA's own website, made this comment. "I think very definitely as we go out beyond low Earth orbit and do missions in deep space, that they will be international as well, and we will build on the relationships and the partnerships and the agreements that we have built up through the International Space Station as we go out beyond low Earth orbit." Once again, in making that statement, it's clear they have not yet done it. They're working together internationally. You know, not only are these international teams helping to push the new world order, but it's an admission that NASA can't do it alone. We need to cooperate with other experts around the world, put our joint efforts together to surmount this major barrier. The Van Allen belts. You know what they're proposing now? This was, I don't have it in these notes. I mentioned it on another show NASA came out, oh, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago and made a statement that it's not likely that we're going to be able to return to the moon until we develop a technology such that we will be able to produce a powerful magnetic field around a spacecraft that can act like the Earth's magnetic field and divert dangerous particles away from the spacecraft. Did you catch that? Now, that sounds feasible. That sounds like a scientific resolution to the problem. Yes, that would do it if they can create a powerful enough magnetic field to protect the occupants, you know, blah, blah, blah. But again, she's saying that they don't have that ability yet. They're working on it for the future. Well, how the fuck were the Apollo astronauts supposed to have been protected? They didn't have that shit back then. Those capsules weren't even made out of lead. Basically a fucking tin can, right? Radiation could easily have penetrated one of those things. They didn't go through the fucking Van Allen belts. No goddamn way. Anyway, caller, are you there? Did you want to make a comment?
Hi, Charles. Just calling to listen and learn.
Oh, okay, man. I'll put you on mute then.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no problem. So, you know, that's it, guys. Their own admission. You give a liar enough space, and sooner or later, he'll talk himself into his own trap. They do it all the time. Sometimes wittingly just to fuck with you. But there's other times, though, they just plain fuck up. They can't get their shit straight. How many times have we seen this with all the fake shootings, guys? All you got to do is just let them talk. And sooner or later, yep, they talk themselves right into their own trap. Pay attention to what they say. Same with 9/11, guys. Some of the best proofs 9/11 was full of shit was to listen to these assholes. Remember Dumsfeld and his comment about the missile hitting the Pentagon or the plane that was shot down in Pennsylvania? Remember that shit? He actually fucking said that. So, once again, guys, by their own admission, we didn't go to the moon. No way. Now, like I said, I still believe that we have the ability to go into low Earth orbit. But a lot of the missions that they
hasn't moved. You got 2 days to
okay, I had somebody else that wasn't on mute. Oh, actually. Maybe that person wants to come on. Hold on. Caller, 208 area code. Did you want to come on? Oh, I guess not. All right. Anyway, I forgot my point now. Oh, it slipped me. But just on these admissions alone, guys, we can tell. We there's no way. Even with our technology now, 50 years out from Apollo, we still can't do what we supposedly did 50 years ago with a technology that was infinitely inferior to what we have now, right? I mean, we basically went from horse and buggies to, you know, friggin' Jetsons in 50 years, right? So we're supposed to have gone to the moon with horse and buggy technology, and now with Jetson-type technology, we still can't do it? Think about that. It's phenomenal. The horse shit we're being sold. Here's another beauty. Listen to this one. President illegal alien Obama has himself made a similar statement. He said, early in the next decade, a set of crewed flights will test and prove the systems required for exploration beyond low Earth orbit. Did you catch that? Holy shit. God damn it, man. It's unbelievable. Early in the next decade, a set of crewed flights will test and prove the systems required for exploration beyond low Earth orbit. We haven't done it yet. We haven't done it. These last few statements I just read, and they're from very authoritative people, right? How more authoritative can you get than NASA officials and Mr. fucking El Presidente himself? Telling you that they're working on this technology, we don't have it. Their goal is to leave low Earth orbit. Still another NASA female scientist, ostensibly aboard the space station, stated, quote, "And this, the work on the space station, is really the beginning, I think, of human beings leaving lower Earth orbit." Oh, my God, guys. Look how many statements that have been made like this, all saying the same thing, that we have not been able as yet, with all the shuttle missions, with all the, you know, orbital craft, blah, 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 as far as human beings, anyway, we have not been able to leave low Earth orbit. Can't survive. Radiation is too deadly. And then there's this shocker. NASA astronaut Don Pettit. This has got to be my favorite. Let's see. Hold on. Oh, okay. Let's see what I did. Thought I had a mistake in my notes. Anyway, yeah, Don Pettit. I cited from him last night, another whopper of a quote. But anyways, this one tops that one. He gave the following as the reason why we haven't returned to the moon since the early 70s. This is the answer he gave. Some of you, I'm sure, have already heard this before, but check this out. "I'd go to the moon in a nanosecond," he said. "But the problem is we don't have the technology to do that anymore. We used to, but we destroyed that technology. And it's a painful process to build it back again." Cut the shit. This is from International Business Times, September 21st of 2016. So almost 2 years ago, he made that comment. "We used to have the technology, but we don't have it anymore. We destroyed that technology." He doesn't even say we lost it, which would also be a joke. But he said we destroyed it. We had it, and we deliberately destroyed it. Are you fucking kidding? That's like saying, "Well, we used to know how to build a nuclear bomb, but we destroyed that technology. We don't know how to do it anymore. We don't know how to make a cell phone anymore." Holy fucking shit. You believe that, guys? You have my sympathies. You should seek some medical treatment, mental health treatment. All right, guys, short break. Right back.
Steve Guttel, who was president and CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs.
There are two issues at the top of our agenda at the very moment. One is the unbelievably important immigration debate in this country, to make sure that immigrants from around the world, particularly those from south of our border, have a chance here.
And here's an interview with Rabbi Goldschmidt.
Essentially, what you're saying is that in this boat, you're together with both Muslims
yes.
And people of other nations.
And we see ourselves together, fighting together with our Muslim brothers.
Thanks, Jews.
I'm a traveler of both time and space.
All right, guys, welcome back. As many of you know, the company SpaceX. That's an interesting name, by the way, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. SpaceX has been supposedly putting several communication satellites up into orbit over the past several years and plans to be putting more up in the future. This company announced that it was going to be placing cameras outside of their rockets to broadcast live footage of their rockets leaving the Earth's atmosphere and entering the vacuum of space. However, on March 30th of this year, one such camera suddenly failed as the rocket was about to penetrate past the outer limits of the atmosphere, and no explanation was available at the time for this failure. What's up with that? It later turned out that NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, it turns out was responsible for this failure. And how so? They cut the camera feed, we're told. And why? Because NOAA said SpaceX was violating their regulations, which restricts how many cameras can be sent out into space. Are you fucking shitting me, guys? I kid you not. This actually happened earlier this year in March. The NOAA cut off the cameras and they said, oh, well, you're violating our policy. We only allow so many. What the fuck? Now, you know, those who deny this outer space would want you to think that that's because there is no outer space. They don't want you to see that. Shut the fuck up. No, guys, they got something to hide. There's no question about it. They're not hiding that there's no outer space, but they are hiding something. To cut the cameras off so you can't see this thing entering into outer space. What the fuck do they have out there they don't want you to see? Doing this, said the NOAA, requires a provisional license, which the company doesn't have. Can you believe this? NOAA released this statement about their action. They said, the National and Commercial Space Program Act requires a commercial remote sensing license for companies having the capacity to take an image of Earth while in orbit. What the fuck is this horse shit? Now that the launch companies are putting up video cameras on stage two rockets that reach an on-orbit status, all such launches will be held to the requirement of the law and its conditions. You have got it. So now they can just make shit up.
Oh, well, you weren't in compliance. No, you didn't comply with Section 5-3.9. You complied with all the other sections, but you missed that one.
So they can just keep making shit up as to why they're not going to allow pictures to be fucking cut the shit.
This is kind of like, oh, well, you could take that that butter knife on that plane with you, but not that book of matches.
Get the fuck out of here. They won't let this or any other company stream live videos of outer space, guys. They won't let the Earth be shown. What in the hell is that all about? What exactly are they hiding? No, sorry, it's not that there's no outer space and a bunch of other fairy tales that a lot of the truthers have fucking latched onto. But they are hiding something, guys. There's something out there they don't want you to see. NOAA also stated, quote, security conditions on Earth, imaging to protect national security are common to all licenses for launches with on-orbit capabilities.
In other words, it's not just us. Other nations are doing it too. Yeah, because you're all scratching each other's asses. You're all in bed with each other. You all mutually have shit to hide. You're all mutually screwing your populations with wide open borders, allowing mass influx of illegal aliens and exporting millions of jobs, hemorrhaging your economies, raping people with high taxes and fucking them with no benefits for them, but plenty of benefits for the illegals that are coming in. On and on and on it goes. Jesus Christ. Notice national security. National security. Anyway, so there you have it, guys. There's a whole lot of lying going on, isn't there? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. NASA's certainly no exception to the rule. What exactly is happening out in space, and how much of what we are being told is really happening? Clearly, if they do have a space station, they do not want us seeing what is taking place aboard the damn thing. And that would certainly explain all the obvious fakery, right? You know, the friggin' women astronauts floating with their hair stiff, obviously inundated with frickin' hairspray, right? The hair isn't flowing, like I said. It all moves together as one solid piece. Sure, it's standing up because it's been hairsprayed, but it's not standing up because, you know, the friggin' bimbo is in weightless space. Nope. Look how stupid, guys, people are falling for this shit. They can't see stuff that's right there in their face. It shows how totally incapable people are of thinking at all, never mind critically. You don't even have to be critical to spot that. Common sense should say, even if you don't think the government's lying, NASA's lying, people should at least be saying, wow, isn't that strange? Look at her hair. It's not flowing. It's just one solid piece. They don't even fucking say that. The cognitive dissonance is so bad that people can't even with a non-critical comment, they can't even take note of fucking shit like that. It scares the hell out of me. And yet they consider themselves educated. Smart thinkers. Bullshit. Just like when Dumsfeld, you know, made those comments about the fucking missile hitting the Pentagon, the plane being shot down in Pennsylvania. You can point it out to people. You can show them the video clips of Rumsfeld saying it, and they'll fucking brush it off. They won't even admit that it's significant. Oh, he made a mistake. He made two big mistakes, didn't he? Anyway. Well, that concludes that discussion. I mentioned, you know, that I want to get into talking about our little tribal bastard friends and their sabotage of the Assyrian Empire. And then, you know, several other old world empires are going to follow that discussion up with that. I am going to get to that, but probably not tonight. Probably Wednesday next week, the second half, because what I'm going to start covering now will take us at least to through the first half of next show next week. Two more science-related topics, and then I'll get into some more ancient history stuff. Let's see, what did I have here? Yeah, I mentioned, I think it was last week, I wanted to discuss this anomaly. Not an anomaly, a downright error regarding one of Johannes Kepler's three planetary laws. And so let's do that now. It's pretty interesting. Like so many other things in our modern world, Keplerian theories about planetary motion might not be the absolute scientific truth that we have been taught they were. Upon close inspection, there appears to be something definitely wrong with them, or at least with one of them, which means that in this area as well, we have been hemmed in and held back
by the scientific community for centuries. Let's look at Kepler's three planetary motion laws. Johannes Kepler, 1571 to 1630, was a German mathematician, astronomer, and astrologer. Usually they went hand in hand. Astrology was considered a science like astronomy. Anyway, he had served as the official mathematician at the Royal Habsburg Court. He's best known, again, for his three laws of planetary motion, based on his works, Astronomia Nova, Amonis's Mundi, and Epitome of Copernican Astronomy. These works also provided one of the foundations for Isaac Newton's theory of universal gravitation, which also has its problems, but, you know, we won't go into that now. I remember years ago, I used to think that Isaac Newton was a great man. And why? Because he was a Bible scholar. Well, a very twisted Bible scholar at that. I mean, the Bible's twisted anyway, but he twisted it with a Masonic bent, guys. He was a goddamn Freemason. And another flagrant militant homosexual, too, I might add. He's a piece of crap. Piece of crap. But, you know, because he had quoted from the Bible on numerous occasions, I thought, oh, well, you know, such a godly man. I don't know, please. Bible quoters, guys, very often are the very opposite of what people think they are. And they only quote from the Bible to make themselves look good. I can tell you firsthand that most Christians do that, guys. Most of the Christians I've known through my life, you know, only went to church to give themselves, to make themselves look good. That's it. And, well, you know, others have other bizarre motives, too. A nice social club. They like the potluck dinners in the afternoon after church, or you know, they lust after Sister Susie McGillicuddy or whatever the fuck, you know. Anyway, as you can see, once a cracked foundation is laid, every other theory that comes along, if built on that cracked foundation, will also, by default, be cracked itself, right? Anyway, you know, such is the case with Einsteinian physics, right? You know, it's not even his theory. Once again, he copied from the French scientist Poincaré, who was a pretty smart guy, but he was wrong. You know, his relativity thing, just it's not true, guys. But because they've shoved that down our throats for so long, and it's become the status quo dogma in physics, you know, there have been scientists that have done calculations and it doesn't harmonize with Einsteinian physics. And so you know what they've done? They've scrapped the whole damn thing and started over. You know, back to the drawing board. We have been thwarted for over 100 years now by this horse shit. How much longer? You know, I some of you might recall I did a show on Einstein a while back. There are several mainstream physicists who have admitted that Einstein was a charlatan. And they said the only reason why we still push him is because he's good PR for us in the physics community, you know. They admit that he's a fraud. Can you believe it? Anyway, Kepler's laws of planetary motion deal with the dynamics of planets' orbital motions around the sun. These laws are as follows. The first one is the orbit of a planet is an ellipse with the sun at one of the two foci. When you have an ellipse, you don't have one foci, your focal point, you know, which you would have in a perfectly round orbit, right? The sun would be at the center of a perfectly round orbit. When you have an ellipse, the sun is at one focal point, according to Mr. Kepler.
pretty much, he says, all of the planets have orbit in an ellipse, not a perfect circle. And so the sun exists, resides in one of the focal points of that ellipse. The second rule is that a line segment joining a planet and the sun sweeps out equal areas during equal intervals of time. Well, that seems to pan out. That's true. Problem lies with the first law that I just mentioned. We'll get to that shortly. The second law seems to be true, yes. When a planet is closer to the sun, it moves faster than it does when it's further away. Or so, well, actually, there's problems with this one, too, because of the fact that there's problems with the first law. But from what we can tell visually, that seems to be the case. Mathematically, it works out. Even though a planet moves further, faster when it's closer in than it does when it's further out, it sweeps out an equal amount of space in the same amount of time. The third law is the square of the orbital period of a planet is proportional to the cube of the semi-major axis of its orbit. The problem here lies, once again, with Kepler's first law, that planetary orbits are ellipses with the sun at one foci. And by default, the second one is affected as well. The third one, again, is pretty sound. That same law applies, by the way, with the orbits, if you can call them that, of electrons around an atom. The square of the orbital period of an electron is proportional to the cube of the semi-major axis of its orbit. But anyways, what's wrong with the first law in Kepler's three planetary motion laws, which states, again, the orbit of a planet is an ellipse with the sun at one foci? Well, think about it. For centuries, scientists and lay people alike have accepted Kepler's first law without even asking the most basic fundamental question. How can the sun be the center of gravity in the solar system if the planets revolve in elliptical orbits instead of circular ones? Think about it. Or, you could put it this way, how can the sun be the center of gravity if it resides at one foci of planetary orbital ellipses? Do you see my problem? There's a serious imbalance here. How, you know, if we're supposedly falling into the sun, how do planetary orbits maintain an ellipse? You would think that the powerful gravitational force of the sun, even if something knocked a planet out of its orbit and pushed it out, say, 500,000 miles or something to distort its orbit, how much time do you think it would take for that distorted orbit to correct itself and become circular again? Because the sun's gravity pulling on that planet equally from all sides, it would, you know, common sense, right, would demand that that distorted orbit, because something impacted it and caused the object to move further away from the sun, something would force it back into a circle. It would either fall back into the original slot where it was, or if it was pushed out far enough, it would develop a new orbit slightly further away from the sun, but yet still orbiting in a circle, because the sun, once again, pulling on it equally from all sides, would absolutely require a circular orbit. Do you understand what I'm saying? Since an ellipse requires two foci, would this not of necessity require two suns? You would have to have two suns that we're orbiting if, in fact, we orbit in ellipses, us and other planets, right? To keep the thing in balance, there would have to be two suns, and therefore, yes, because the suns are close to each other, the planets would be orbiting those two suns in an ellipse. You couldn't be a circle then, because the two suns would distort the orbits of the planets. But that's not what we have. We have one sun, and yet all the planets, some much more so than others, but all the planets, we're told, are orbiting in ellipses. Something's wrong here, guys. It just defies common sense. Once again, common sense absolutely demands that if the sun is indeed the focal point of the planetary orbits, there can't be two focal points, there can only be one, and these orbits must be perfect circles and not ellipses. Even Kepler himself seemed to have trouble with this. he recognized that it just didn't make sense. According to Carl Sagan in his Cosmos series, Kepler confessed the ellipse to be, quote, only a single cart full of dung. He actually said that. To him, it just defied logic, defied common sense. Scientists just accept it today, or at least they want us to accept it, and so most people just accept it without question. But if you really stop and think about it, guys, it doesn't add up. It doesn't add up. So, why the confusion? Why has Kepler, and indeed every scientist since, pretty much, believed planetary orbits to be ellipses when they must certainly be circles? That's the big question. Let's take a look here. Apparently, the answer lies in one word, and that's simply perspective. Today's heretic scientists who recognize that something is wrong with Kepler's first law have a simple explanation as to why so many scientists believe circular planetary orbits are ellipses instead. The problem lies in perspective, they say. Here's how it works. If you view a glass from above, directly overhead, its rim, of course, looks perfectly round, does it not? But if you view that same glass from a 45-degree angle, that round rim now looks like what? A very elongated ellipse, correct? And so this is the argument that the heretic scientists that don't accept elliptical orbits use. They say that these planetary orbits to us look elliptical, right? Because we're not seeing them from above. We're seeing them, we all essentially orbit in one plane. Now, there are diversions, you know. In fact, the Earth's orbit is used as the standard. It's called the plane of the ecliptic. And so to measure how far off another planet is from the ecliptic, you know, they'll give, you know, 3 degrees for this one or 0.05 degrees for that one, which means that it's off that many degrees from the ecliptic or the Earth's plane of the Earth's orbit. No other planet is totally in line with the ecliptic, but for the most part, they are. The one planet that diverges mostly, although it's demoted now, it's not called a planet anymore, is Pluto. But for the most part, the rest of the planets, you know, for all practical purposes, do reside in essentially the same plane. By the way, that presents another problem, doesn't it, for the theory of accretion for the formation of planets. You know, they say that billions of years ago, there was a period called the Great Bombardment Period, when all this debris streaming away from the sun coalesced to form the planets the way we now know them. And that's why we see the hard-bodied planets, the inner planets like Mercury, Venus, you know, Earth and Mars, loaded with craters, because that dates back to this bombardment period. Ah, shut the hell up. You're so full of shit. If that were true, guys, why is it that the sun's equator is tipped significantly out of line with the plane that most of the planets, you know, orbit in? Planets don't orbit in the same plane. If the planets were accreted out of the rotating solar disk, right, leftover material that didn't become part of the sun, how come the sun is tilted completely out of whack with the plane of that the planets orbit in, you know, the ecliptic? Why? Is that fucked up or what? Look at the shit they sell us, guys. Again, I don't mind scientists coming up with theories, whatever. Everybody can have their own little pet theory. But it doesn't add up. That theory needs to be tossed. Forget it. What could have caused the sun to tip out of sync with the plane of the planets? Or better yet, what could have caused the planets to tip out of sync with the sun's equator, all in unison with each other? To me, that throws the whole theory right out the window there of planetary accretion from solar materials. Forget it. Come up with something else. Move on. So much of what they sell us, guys, is pure horseshit. So much of it. String theory, fuck that. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. It's all it is, goddamn theory. Just like E equals MC squared. It's all bullshit, guys. It's bullshit. Does it sound interesting? Oh, yeah. But is there any truth to it? It's a fucking theory. Black holes, like I said, are a theory. Black mass or dark energy, black matter or whatever. It's all a theory. By the way, black matter is a theory that was invented just to account for what they think is missing gravity. But when you realize, like I said, what was it last week, that the universe is dominated not so much by gravity, guys, but much more so by electromagnetic forces, right? Plasma forces. So plasma accounts for what they think is missing gravity. You don't have to invent shit like dark matter. Forget it. It's over. If you're not familiar with plasma cosmology and you're interested in astronomy, you really got to read up on that. That's great shit. I've talked about it in the past. You know, in the future, I'll probably return to that. It's great. Absolutely fantastic. When I first discovered that, I was like in my glory. I'm like, oh my God, this explains so many things that don't make sense. But, you know, I won't go into that now. Most of you probably heard that anyway. So guess what, guys? The illustration I used with the glass, when you look down at the rim, it's a circle. When you look at the glass from an angle, it becomes an ellipse. And so apparently that's what it is with planetary orbits. They look like ellipses, but apparently that's not the case, guys. Now we don't have to explain how the sun can exist, which Kepler himself called a cart of dung, right? But yet he wrote it as one of his laws. We don't have to accept it. The ridiculous notion of the sun rests in one whole guy while the planet orbits and ellipses. No, we can toss that one out the window. There's no good orbit. I can't get that question.
First professing Jew to be elected the United States Senate, Judah. See how efficiently he ran his sugarcane plantation with 140 slaves, Judah. Imagine his courage as he resigned from the United States Senate to serve as Secretary General, Secretary of War, and later as Secretary of State for the Confederacy. His image is on Confederate money, Judah. Watch as Jews help in his spectacular escape after the war ended, and enjoy how the Rothschild dynasty rewarded the first Jew in the U.S. Senate for protecting their financial investment in the African slave industry and effort to destroy the United States. Judah, coming this fall.
Leave them kids alone.
Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Guys, welcome back. So let's take a look now at some very interesting admissions or confessions. Modern Kepler fans have often made indirect admissions that the motions of Keplerian elliptical orbits are not really on very solid ground. For example, Wikipedia states, most planetary orbits are almost circles, and careful observation and calculation are required in order to establish that they are actually ellipses. Careful observation. Do you see what this is doing? This is almost an admission that in case somebody tries to, you know, undertake the effort of taking measurements, and, you know, it's very tedious. It's very difficult. You really do need computers to do it today. And they're afraid that if you did it, your calculations would show, in fact, that the orbits aren't ellipses but are circles. So what they're doing here is they don't want to give up their precious dogma. So they're telling you that almost all the planets are circles, but what makes them eccentric is very minor aberrations. And so it takes real advanced mathematics such that, yeah, if you came out with a circle, you know, you'd be convinced by reading stuff like this that, oh, well, my calculations, you know, as good as I tried to make them be, they obviously are not on a par with NASA. They're much farther, more advanced than me. They have more advanced instruments at their disposal. So they're able to detect the fact that we're dealing with eccentric orbits rather than circular. You see my point? When the truth is, it's just bullshit. It's just bullshit. This same article then went on to point out that Kepler's methodology wasn't very reliable. Well, if so, why are we still following him then? The article states, using calculations of the orbit of Mars from Tycho Brahe, whose published values are somewhat suspect, which indicated elliptical orbits, Johannes Kepler inferred that other heavenly bodies, including those further away from the sun, also have elliptical orbits. Do you see what this is saying? They're saying that Kepler's measurements, which is what all these laws are based on, right, which is still being used and taught in the textbooks today, they're admitting here that the observations were flawed and his math was flawed, and that he was basing his idea of the other planetary bodies being ellipses on inferences. So this is an indirect admission that we're still following flawed science, flawed measurements, flawed math, and inferences. Wow. Think about that, guys. Oh, there's been a lot of inferring ever since. It hasn't stopped, has it? But notice how this article admitted that Tycho Brahe's records were suspect. In other words, the whole premise of Kepler's first law was based on shaky data, and yet they're still accepting it and teaching it today. You see how dangerous it is to be so stuck, so set in your ways? You know, we're dealing here, obviously, with more than pride. These are just lying bastards. But even pride can accomplish this same thing. Once you get an idea set, you don't want to let go. It's like a goddamn religion, right? Science and religion, guys, even though they're often at odds with one another, they actually operate exactly the same. They're kindred spirits. They really are. Scientists and ministers. They really are. They're both pushing dogmatic ideas. They both have belief systems that aren't necessarily, very often, are not based on fact, more so with religion than science. But, you know, I mean, really, what's the difference? They'll come down on you with fury and condemn your soul to hell, fire you or you know, have you banished or whatever, blacklisted, so that you, if you work in one of those professions, you're dead in the water, you know. Anyway. What about variations in planetary orbital speed, which I mentioned before, which is Kepler's second law, you know, that a planet drawing a straight line out from the center of the sun as it orbits will sweep out an equal space in an equal amount of time, even though it goes faster at some parts of its orbit and slower at other parts. Kepler noted, as have all scientists since, that planets at least seem to orbit faster during perihelion, the point where the planet is closer to the sun, and orbit slower at aphelion, when the planet is farther away from the sun. This claim, Keplerian scientists, is proof of the elliptical nature of planetary orbits. But observation in this case proves nothing, ladies and gentlemen. Nothing. All we are dealing with here, once again, is perspective. And there are two factors that contribute to this illusion. Number one, the Earth's proximity to the observed orbiting planet. The Earth's distance from the observed orbital body can give the impression that this object is moving slower when it is further from the Earth and faster when it is closer. It might look like it's moving faster because it's in closer proximity to the sun, but no, it's only because it's moving seemingly faster because of its closer proximity to the Earth. The second factor is the ellipse illusion. Because the circular orbits of the planets look like ellipses from our perspective, planetary bodies are naturally going to appear to be moving slower when viewed moving in one of the long stretches of their apparent elliptical paths, and faster when viewed moving around the loop of one of either of the far ends of their apparent elliptical paths as seen from our perspective. You know what I'm saying? So it's not that they're moving faster, according to Keplerian astronomy, you know. They're not moving faster because they're closer to the sun. They're moving faster because from our perspective, number one, it's, you know, because they're closer to us at the time, and or because the planet is in one of its edges of its orbit as seen from our perspective. It seems like it's moving quicker because it's near the edge, and would look slower when it's like in the middle on one of its long lanes, one of its long stretches. You understand what I'm saying? So that's it, guys. So much for planetary orbits being ellipses. Now, you might be saying, well, what's the big deal? What does it matter? The math still works out. Yeah, the math still works out either way. But once again, Don't you want to know the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth? And doesn't it suck that you kind of get semi-admissions from places like, you know, Wikipedia, which basically are coming out and saying that, well, it looks like the orbits are circular after all, and Kepler's ideas were based on faulty observations, records of observations, and faulty math, you know, blah, 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 blah. Kepler himself said it was a cart of dung, the idea of planets orbiting with the sun at one of the foci, right? So, once again, it looks like we are, in fact, being lied to about this, too. So, even though it might not seem like a big deal, and it doesn't upset, you know, how the math plays out, it's still a lie, right? Common sense, guys, without even having to know much about physics, if you understand that the sun is, you know, that planets are orbiting the sun, how could the sun be anywhere but at the center of that orbit? How could the orbit possibly be elongated if there's not another sun in the center of that orbit? The sun pulling equally as we go around it would obviously force the Earth. It couldn't remain in an ellipse for very long. If something knocked us out of whack, yeah, it would distort that perfect circle, but it would almost immediately correct itself and wind up a circle again, being pulled on equally from every direction as we orbit. You see what I'm saying? So planetary orbits of necessity can't be ellipses. And yet, pick up any textbook on astronomy, and that's what they're going to tell you. Bullshit. Not buying it. Not anymore. Anyway, all right. That concludes that. I have one more science-related set of notes that I wanted to cover. That should take us to the end of today's show. And then next week we'll get into the ancient, I might even finish this next set of notes before the end of the show. I mentioned, I don't know, a few weeks back that I wanted to cover this. So here it is. Jonathan Swift a lot of science textbooks, you know, especially when you talk about planetary astronomy, planetary physics, you know, especially when you talk about Mars and its moons and how they were discovered, you know, blah, 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 blah. Almost always they mention this seemingly mind-blowing, anomalous story of how the two moons of Mars were, quote, predicted accurately. Well, let's put this under the microscope and see if this is yet another bullshit story we've been sold. Science, or what is called science, just like religion, once again, has its own share of fantasies and fairy tales and legends that it tells the public just to create hype and place their founding pillars high up on a pedestal, just like religion likes to do, right? Saint this, saint that, buy this scapula medal, that scapula medal. Science likes to do the same thing, especially when you realize that a lot of the pioneers of science, especially in the last several centuries, have all been goddamn fellow 33rd degree Masons and members of the British Royal Society. So naturally, they want you to worship their idols, just like in the religion context, right? They want you to worship this saint and that saint, pray to this saint for this, you know, the saint of dick warts, or the saint of hemorrhoids, or whatever. You know, they got a saint for everything under the frickin' sun, right? And they got you praying to these frickin' people. Are you shitting me? Science is no different, guys. They have their share of saints and basically have you worshiping them, too. Jonathan Swift is yet another example of this. And guess what, ladies and gentlemen? Getting ahead of myself here a little bit, but Jonathan Swift was a major Masonic whore bastard. Yes, he was. Anyway, start at the beginning here. In 1726, English author Jonathan Swift published his famous novel, Gulliver's Travels. Some of you, if you're an old fart like me, will remember the cartoon back in the early 70s, or shit, I think it might have been 60s, and I was watching them as reruns in the early 70s, I don't know. But in any case, I used to watch them Saturday mornings with, remember the Saturday morning cartoons? Geez, they don't even have that anymore. Another thing this generation has been ripped off But then it's probably just as well, because today's cartoons would be so morally depraved anyway. The ones that are out there are bad. But if they still had Saturday morning cartoons, you can just imagine. So maybe it's good they don't have it. I don't know. But I used to love it. They used to have great cartoons Saturday morning. Some of you, I'm sure, remember that. And the prize and the cereals. Shit, they used to dictate what cereal I bought. No more goddamn prizes in the cereal. Now all that you get is the poison shit, which, you know, it wasn't good when we were kids either, but it's far worse now. They weren't using high fructose corn syrup, for example. Anyway, in this work, Gulliver's Travels, the character Gulliver visited the land of Laputia, or Laputia, a floating island of crazy scientists. Speaking of the astronomers of this island, Gulliver stated, quote, and weren't they supposed to be tiny people, and Gulliver was a giant too, if I remember right? Yeah, pretty sure that's how that went. My God, it's so long ago now. Anyway, speaking of astronomers of this island, Gulliver is pictured as stating, "They have likewise discovered two lesser stars or satellites, which revolve around Mars, whereof the innermost is distant from the center of the primary," meaning the center of Mars, "exactly three of his diameters, and the outermost five." The outermost planet is five diameters. The former revolves in the space of 10 hours and the latter in 21 and a half hours. So not only was Gulliver here, or Jonathan Swift, who wrote this, seemingly predicting that Mars had two satellites, which is accurate. It does. Very small, most likely captured asteroids, but two satellites nonetheless. But in a rough sense, he actually accurately foretold the positions of these satellites and their orbits. The two moons of Mars, Phobos and Deimos, were later discovered by Asaph Hall Sr. on August 12, 1877, the next century after Gulliver wrote, Swift wrote Gulliver's Travel. 151 years, actually, after Swift wrote his novel. And so they'll always point this out as one of those strange anomalies. The man almost seems like a prophet. I think one science text actually used the word prophet. Anyway, but it's not just that the existence of these two moons was predicted. There's also the relative accuracy, like I said, of the prediction of their relative sizes and positions. Swift and Swift said that one moon took 21 and a half hours to orbit Mars, whereas the moon Deimos orbits its parent planet Mars in just over 30 hours. So, you know, some might say, well, that's not that accurate. Oh, that's pretty goddamn, that's not bad. Close enough. It's pretty bizarre. 21 and a half versus 30. Accurate enough so that it makes you go, he did foretell that Mars had two. How would he have known this? Swift stated that Mars's other moon orbited Mars in 10 hours, while Phobos does so in 7 hours and 39 minutes, so almost 8 hours. Again, that's pretty damn accurate, right? So he not only predicted that Mars had two moons, but pretty accurately predicted how long their orbital periods were. Swift's forecasts of the distances of these moons from Mars were not so accurate. He was, you know, a lot more off on that one, but nevertheless, pretty astonishing. Phobos and Deimos have orbits which are about 1.4 and 3.5 diameters from Mars' center, respectively, whereas the Plutians gave figures of 3 and 5. So,
Yeah, that's off by quite a bit. Well, one is right, 3 and 3.5, but the other one is 1.4. That's not even close to 5. So one of them was pretty close. But like I said, nevertheless, guys, how is this possible? People are still amazed that he made such a quote prediction, right? But was this a bizarre coincidence, really? Was it a prediction? Was it something that we should ooh and ah over? Was Swift a genius or perhaps a prophet of science? No, 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 not at all. In reality, the idea of Mars having two satellites goes back to the ancient Greeks. In their mythology, the Greeks made mention of Ares or Mars having two companions, two blazing steeds, Phobos and Deimos, from whence the Martian satellites got their modern names, right? The Greeks knew Mars had two satellites. Now you might ask, well, how'd they know that? Guys, the ancients had lenses, okay? They did. There's one on display over in Syria. At an ancient Syrian site, they found a lens, okay? So that would explain why, you know, Jupiter was known by some ancient cultures to have four satellites, four companions, if you will. Saturn was even known to have goddamn rings. How do you like them apples? Anyway, Hesiod wrote thusly of this triune Martian arrangement. He said, quote, Ares, again, Mars, sceptered king of manliness, who whirls your fiery sphere. Notice it was called a sphere. That's interesting. Whirls your fiery sphere among the planets in their sevenfold courses through the aether, wherein your blazing steeds, Deimos and Phobos, ever bear you above the third firmament of heaven. They like that. So the ancient Greeks were aware that Mars had two companions, though flavored with fancy, legendary language here. There's still some science involved behind it. That's how it goes with ancient legends. A lot of times they conveyed real stories, but flavored them up so much that a lot of people today in academia completely write them off, which is friggin' stupid, because a lot of those ancient legends contain a lot of important elements of truth. Coming up to the early 17th century, Johannes Kepler's 1610 memoir, in which he interpreted some of Galileo's cryptic writings to say, quote, hail, twin companionship, children of Mars, or I greet you, double knob, children of Mars. Galileo wrote in code, basically, because he'd already gotten himself a lot of trouble by saying that Jupiter had four moons. So Galileo had to hide the fact now that he discovered Mars to have two moons. He wrote it in encrypted here, but Kepler came along and translated it and realized that Galileo was aware of Mars having, quote, twin companionship, children of Mars. Galileo saw these two moons of Mars two centuries before they were officially discovered in more modern times. Anyway, so apparently, Galileo and thus Kepler also knew that Mars had two moons. We can surmise, then, that it was always known since ancient times, because the Greeks were aware of this as well, right, that Mars had two moons. And thus, Gulliver's travels here, didn't provide anything profound. Swift was not a genius. He was not a prophet. The fact that he was a Mason, guys, of course he was going to be clued in on this hidden knowledge
So when you hear Mason's boast about Brother Swift, you can laugh at him. And they know it, too. They know the horse shit that's been sold to the general public. There's nothing mystical or magical about what he said. Nothing at all. So there's another fairy tale from science that we can write off. Well, what do you know, guys? I finished that much quicker than I thought I would. So we can actually get started on tribal takedown of Assyria in ancient times. Very fascinating discussion. So let me see here. Open that file up. I didn't even have it ready to go. Yeah, here it is. Oh, I don't know how much I'll get. Well, we got over half an hour, so I'll get to cover a little bit of it. But it's going to have to be a cliffhanger, into next week. But we're going to be uncovering some very interesting stuff here. Very, very interesting stuff. The Bible is so completely overflowing with mythology and outright fairy tales that a good many people think that it has no historical value whatsoever. But as I pointed out before, this actually isn't true. There are some significant historical elements of truth in the damn thing, but you got to know how to fish them out, and you got to know how to read it with a grain of salt while looking for those grains of truth. You know, when I covered the conquest of not just Canaan, but all the cities in the Levant, Canaan is Levant for the most part, but you know, the civilizations in North America, in the Indus Valley, how Egypt was almost taken down, and on it goes. The Bible describes those conquests, but, you know, filled with all kinds of hyperbole and outright bullshit, it makes the tribe out to look like Superman who conquered anything that got in their way and stole the land as they went along. Well, they stole the land, all right. But they weren't superhumans they were, as always, like today, they were pussies then, too. They hired others mostly to do their fighting for them. But nevertheless, those battles didn't take place. We can see in the archaeological record where these cities were, in fact, devastated. All right, guys, short break. Be right back.
Jewish professor Noel Ignatieff.
My concern is doing away with whiteness. Whiteness is a form of racial oppression, sure. The suggestion is that it is somehow possible to separate whiteness from oppression, and it is not. There can be no white race without the phenomenon of white supremacy. In the same way, if you abolish racial oppression, you do away with whiteness. Treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity.
Your views are fairly well received in academia.
Yes, they're legitimate. Not to say that everyone agrees, but sure. And the task is to bring this minority together in such a way that it makes it impossible for the legacy of whiteness to continue to reproduce itself.
Fuck.
All right, guys, welcome back. As I was saying, yeah. Not everything in the Bible is complete bullshit. Almost everything, but not everything. The Bible talks about ancient Israel being invaded by the Assyrians, and that actually did happen. There's no question about it. This is thoroughly documented in the historical and archaeological records. So let's take a look at this. The Assyrian rule over ancient Israel. According to mainstream historians, Israel is recorded as having paid tribute to the Assyrians as early as 841 BC as a vassal kingdom. This was during the reign of King Shalmaneser III, or Shalmaneser, excuse me, the III, who recorded this this Israelite tribute on his famous black obelisk, as it's called. The obelisk made of, I think it's either black granite or basalt, I think it is. Anyway. On this stone, he records how the heebie-jeebs were paying him tribute. It also depicts the Israelite king Jehu, mentioned in the Bible, in the Old Testament, bowing before the Assyrian king. And what a sight that is. It's worth looking this up and looking at pictures of it on the internet. It's great to see this tribal little prick, tribal king, bowing to the Assyrian conquering king. And again, it actually names him as Jehu. And Jehu was an actual Old Testament heebie-jeebie king. Anyway. Let's see. There is an accompanying inscription on this obelisk that reads, quote, "The tribute of Jehu, the land of Omri, silver, gold, bowls of gold, vessels of gold, goblets of gold, pitchers of gold, lead, scepters for the king's hand, and staves I received." He's saying how he received all this tribute from Jehu. But you want to bet all this gold mentioned was probably stolen gold from the Egyptians and other places. But in any case, here he is stealing it back from them through tribute. So here the Israelite king, or tribal chieftain really, was forced to pay this tribute to the Assyrian king. These were the good old days, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, yes, yes. Anyway. As you might guess, guys, it wasn't long before the Chosen Ones rebelled against paying such tribute under Israel's king, Hoshea. And we read about this from 2 Kings 17, verses 3 to 6, which says, "Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up to attack Hoshea, who had been Shalmaneser's vassal and had paid him tribute. But the king of Assyria discovered that Hoshea was a traitor, for he had sent envoys to So, king of Egypt, and he no longer paid tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. He decided to rebel because he struck up an alliance with this pharaoh." I know nobody seems to know exactly who Pharaoh So was. That was the Hebrew name that was assigned to him. But in any case, the then reigning Pharaoh, or Egyptian king, they actually didn't call him pharaohs. But anyway, not until after the Greeks occupied Egypt centuries later. Which is another reason to know that the Torah is full of shit. Once again, guys. In the Torah, the word Pharaoh is mentioned over and over. And yet the Torah is supposed to date to, you know, what, 1500 to 1800 BC, somewhere in there. And yet the word pharaoh for Egyptian kings did not emerge again until the Greeks, 500 BC, or actually 300 BC. Imagine that horse shit, huh? Imagine that. Well, actually, probably about 500 BC. The Greek Empire didn't exist yet, but the Greeks had occupied Rome, and had occupied Egypt and had an influence on it. So, yeah, probably about 500 BC or so. But it doesn't matter. We're looking at least 1,000 years after the time that Moses was supposed to have lived, that the Torah was supposed to have been written. And there, the Egyptian kings are being called pharaoh. Are you shitting me? Call that an anachronism, something that appears in a text long before the time that it's supposed to have been able to, you know, to appear. Anyway, this biblical quote continues, therefore Shalmaneser seized him, the Hebrew king, Hoshea, and put him in prison because he was conspiring with the Egyptian king, refusing to pay tribute, right? He knew what this king was up to. He was going to try to launch a rebellion and take out the Assyrian king. The king of Assyria invaded the entire land of Israel, marched against Samaria nearby, and laid siege to it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and deported the Israelites to Assyria. Rah, rah, rah. He settled them in Hala, in Gozan, on the Habor River, and in the towns of the Medes. You know, the Medes later joined up with the Persians, and that's what formed the Medo-Persian Empire. I said that Samaria was near Israel. Actually, at this time, it was actually part of Israel. The Sumerians, in a nutshell, and I think I go into this later, but I might as well mention it now. The Sumerians were a group of people that came from several different backgrounds, cultures, whatever, that the Assyrians had conquered and moved into the area of, you know, next to the Israelites, or part of Israel. And so they wound up, you know, a lot of them wound up speaking Hebrew, and they wound up adopting the Jewish religion, although a great many of them developed their own version of it, and so the temple priests were always against them, which is why by the time of the first century, like you read about in the New Testament, you know, the Pharisees hated the Sumerians, you know, that they were looked down at. They were snubbed. Lowlifes, you know, because they weren't true Jews. They don't kiss our ass. They don't accept, you know, the temple priests and their version of the religion. They perverted the original Jewish religion, you know, blah, 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 blah. And also, you can bet they hated them because they weren't pure blood Jews. Not that there ever really has been pure blood Jews ever, because once again, guys have always intermarried to poison the blood line, you know, and make themselves like chameleons, blend in so they can more easily engage in their crimes undetected. But nevertheless, because they weren't considered to be, quote, true Jews, either religion-wise or genetic-wise, you know, they were a mixed breed, they didn't like them. To give the background on that. But notice how this passage admitted that the Assyrians overtook Hoshea because he was a traitor who refused to pay tribute or refused to pay taxes. Oh, how many times have we seen this? In the course of this discussion, you know, going into next week about their sabotaging of ancient empires, we're going to see quite a few examples of this. Yes, yes, yes. Right on up into modern times. They have no problem with imposing taxes on others or getting other leaders to impose taxes that they benefit from. Yes. But they always have resisted taxes, even when the taxes have not been oppressive. To them, they're oppressive if they have to pay them at all. Doesn't matter that those taxes have benefited them and built their fucking temple for them. They've always engaged in uprisings and, you know, civil disobedience of all types, just to get out of, you know, taxes, to avoid taxes. When they would fund this, that, or the other emperor, later the emperor would grant them tax exemption because that was the condition given originally. People think it was out of the goodness of the emperor's heart. No, he just did it out of thanks for them giving him all the shekels to help fund his imperialistic campaigns. Anyway, moving on in this passage now, verses 6 through 18, give the reason for the success of the Assyrians over the Chosenites. And it's not because they were rebelling against the great Yah. That's the reason given in the Old Testament for why Israel was conquered by Assyria. They rebelled against my righteous and holy name. Therefore, I gave them over to their enemies. But no, that's not the reason. But first, let's look at the big bullshit lie that we're sold in the Bible. Here it is, verse 16 to 18. It says, in the ninth year of the reign of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and exiled the Israelites. The whole area of Israel at this time was known as Samaria, both to the Assyrians and the Egyptians, even though it was really only a part of Israel. Anyway, took the area of Samaria and exiled the Israelites to Assyria, and he settled them in Hala at the river Habor, at the river Gozan, and in the cities of Media, you know, the Medes, the Persians. And so it was that the Israelites sinned against the Lord their God. They worshipped other gods and followed the customs of the nations, i.e., the evil, corrupt, and perverted Gentiles. That's what nations means there, literally. So, you know, some translators, in an attempt to try to be politically correct, not to upset people, remove the name Gentile or didn't translate as Gentile, but that's what it means. Anyway, it goes on to say, God had issued warnings in Israel and Judah through the land of all the prophets of any vision, saying, repent from your evil ways and observe my commandments and my decrees. But they did not listen, and they suffered their neck. Then God became very angry with Israel and removed them from his presence. None remained except the tribe of Judah alone. Whatever. So see, what this is doing here is trying to offer an excuse for why Israel wound up in captivity. Oh, wait, you priests have been telling us that God is protecting us, and now here we are, we're in captivity. Well, you weren't obeying. And so then they go back and they write into Holy Writ the idea that God had warned them. You don't remember? Yes, your forefathers were told this. You must have forgotten. God told us generations ago, to obey. And, oh, whatever. We're going to see in a minute what the real reason was. Well, we already touched upon it, but they weren't paying taxes, guys. So let's see now. Who do we trust? The Bible, the Word of God, which says that they went into captivity simply because they were rebellious? Well, doesn't the argument end there? Why look any further? Why should we trust the record of the Assyrians who said that they got invaded because they didn't pay taxes, even though we know that happened time and time and time and time and time and time again and again and again and again and again, every fucking other place they ever went? We have no reason to believe that, we can trust the word of the Assyrians when we have the word of God telling us that the only reason they wound up in captivity to the Assyrians was rebellion against Yahweh. Can you believe this goddamn shit, guys? What a lying son of a bitch of a book. Lie, 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 lie. Even when it tells the truth, it's lying. Like here, it's giving us somewhat of an accurate story, right? Were the Hebrews taken into captivity into Assyria? Yeah, they were. That's true. But in the context of telling that true story, look at the horse shit that we're getting fed. The only reason they were sold into captivity or went into captivity was because they were rebelling against the Yah prick. Oh, and what did that mean, rebelling against them? They didn't kill enough Assyrians in the last battle or didn't rape enough virgin women that they took captive? Get the fuck out of here. You see how this book always has to embellish the stories with the horse shit? The Assyrian record tells us plainly why they were brought into captivity, guys. Rebellious pricks starting insurrections, trying to collaborate with the Egyptians, which, by the way, as you recall, they hated in previous generations, right? All the havoc they wreaked over there with the Hyksos and then later with Akhenaten and raping and pillaging, stealing all their gold, on and on and on and on and on. And here it is now, generations later. Oh, great king in Egypt, wouldst thou not lend us a hand against our common enemy, the Assyrians? And then if Egypt did come through with that help and succeeded, guess what? 5 minutes later, they'd be launching rebellions against Egypt to take them down. Thanks, suckers! That's all they've ever done. That's all they ever will do, guys. But again, I can't stress it enough. Notice how this book waters it down, completely hides the fact that the Hebes wound up in captivity because of their refusal to pay taxes and trying to orchestrate a rebellion, allying themselves or trying to ally themselves with the Egyptian king. They left all that out and made it look like, oh, dummy us, if only we knew, you know, or hadn't forgotten Yahweh. We rebelled. And, oh, knock it off. By the way, it's interesting to note how the Old Testament portrays Hoshea's rise to power. Don't miss this one. 2 Kings 15:30 says, then Hoshea, son of Elah, conspired against the Israelite king Pekah, son of Remaliah. He attacked and assassinated him and then succeeded him as king. Ah! How classic. They even slice the throats of their own folks when it suits their interests. He assassinated his predecessor so he could come to power. He launched an attack and assassinated him. Unbelievable, man. Anyway. He conspired. I love that word. They actually have the word conspired in there. So the tribe, again, even kill their own for power and profit. P-R-O-F-I-T. Anyway, no surprise, not long afterwards, under King Shamshi Adad V, a civil war erupted in Assyria in 824 BC, guys. And why? Because they were pissed that they couldn't get out of paying this tax. They couldn't get Egypt to ally with them. In fact, all it did is piss the Assyrians off and brought a raid upon themselves. So what do? Not long later, they're orchestrating a rebellion. Or better yet, a civil war. They instigate a civil war. Gee, what else have we seen them do that? Huh. Could it be 1861? No. God damn it, guys. Now, I couldn't, you know, find any evidence to absolutely prove that, but Jesus Christ, do you need proof? It's in the pudding, guys. That's their classic MO. I would guarantee you without direct evidence, and there might yet be evidence I haven't discovered yet. If anybody knows of any, let me know. But I guarantee you that they were behind that, goddammit. Anyway, by the mid-8th century BC, our little tribal friends were still paying taxes to Assyria. So guess what happened next? Oh, the familiar pattern. In 746 BC, the Assyrian king, Ashur-nirari V, was deposed in a palace coup, at which time Tiglath-Pileser II assumed the throne. A palace coup. Imagine that. Who do you think was behind that? The tribe were probably hoping that this new king would show them favor especially if they did indeed orchestrate the dethronement of his predecessor. You know, they probably went and weighed some shekels and, hey, we're the guys that helped take this guy out for you and got you in power. But such actually was not the case. This king exacted tribute from the Chosenites as well, which obviously pissed them off, right? This king recorded this inscription that describes tribute he exacted from the Hebes. Here's what he wrote. I received tribute from Menachem of Samaria, or Israel. I received tribute from Jahazi, or Ahaz, of Judah. Ahaz was the king of Judah, and Menachem of Israel. So he was receiving tribute from both. Here's the Old Testament reckoning of this. This comes from 2 Kings 15:19. Then Pul, that was the Hebrew name for Tiglath-Pileser, then Pul, king of Assyria, invaded the land of Israel, and Menachem, king of Israel, gave him 1,000 talents of silver to gain his support. Yeah, right, to gain his support. He didn't have a choice. He was forced to do it. And strengthen his own hold on the kingdom. Yeah, right. He didn't have no strength and hold. He was only allowed to stay in power because he ruled as a vassal to the suzerain lord, you know, the Syrian king. Meanwhile, Ahaz, the king of Judah, was kissing up to Tiglath, hoping to be able, you know, to manipulate him down the line. Kissing up, you know, paying him all these compliments, blah, 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 so that he could fool him, get into his confidence, into his trust, and then screw him, like they always have done. We read this from 2 Kings 16, verses 7 and 8. Ahaz sent messengers to say to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and Ahaz took silver and gold found in the temple of the Lord and in the treasuries of the royal palace and sent it as a gift to the king of Assyria. So imagine that, guys. He was trying to buy him off. He took treasures from the temple, which, you know, that should have been absolute heresy, right? But to him, it didn't matter. He didn't care. Well, I'm not going to take it from my royal court. So I'll take it from the temple. And, you know, just so I can win some favor points with this king and later manipulate him. Unbelievable. Anyway, I think we got a caller on the line. You calling in to comment, caller?
Yes, sir. This is Greg. Greg out in Seattle.
Hey, Greg, what's happening, man? Yeah.
Not much. I was just making sure. Does it still look like Dennis is going to be on next week with you?
Let me see. I forgot the date I had written down.
Week in September.
Second Wednesday of September. So that will actually be the following.
Okay. I was just kind of calling in. I didn't mean to interrupt your show, but to kind of pimp him and you, because I think that will be an incredible show. I'll try to call in.
But yeah, and remind him, too, in case he forgot, Wednesday. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll email him tonight. I'll tell your audience this really quick story, unless you need to get
on. Oh, yeah, sure, good.
So a good friend of mine is a contractor, or was for 13 years in Afghanistan. So he tells me all these stories. I should call you in and just tell you some of the stuff. Like, he doesn't even think there's any war going on in Syria and all this stuff. But anyhow, one of the things he told me, because, Greg, I was on this base for a year, calmest road, everybody was nice in Afghanistan, no trouble, nothing. And he goes, CNN came in one day, set up all their cameras, within an hour there's an explosion, CNN took pictures of it, packed up and left. So I told that story to two of my friends that are, you know, cognitive dissonant, freaking zombies. One of them's a Jew. I'm sitting there telling them the story, and they're looking at me like I'm freaking cross-eyed, and, you know, that I'm a complete idiot or whatever, that I'm a madman. And I look at them, I go, do you guys really think you know more than a guy who was there for 13 years?
Right.
And they just looked at me like, you know, again, I was a complete idiot, and they knew everything, and they had the inside smile chuckle going.
Yeah, typical dumbasses.
Yeah, no, it totally is. Well, I'll let you get back to the rest of your show. I wasn't sure if he was coming on next week or not. I'm glad you told me, so I'll remind him. But I'll definitely call in when Dennis does real quick, too, because you guys will hit it off. And I didn't get to hear tonight's show. I wasn't listening live, but all the ones I've been listening to lately have been great as always, and the best to you.
All right. Hey, same to you. Thanks a lot, man.
All right, buddy. Take care.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye. For those of you that don't know, that's Greg from on the West Coast. He's been on my show many times in the past. Him and Brian calls in from Canada a lot. I've had them both on together. You know, we've done exposés on, well, a lot of stuff, but mostly, you know, on NASA and Apollo missions. Yeah, hopefully, bring back the good old days when I have Brian on talking about that. Maybe we can get Greg in on it, too, because, you know, both of them have done a lot of research on that subject. Real wealth of information on it. And I'm going to be having this friend of his on second Wednesday of next month. Whoa, next month, that's what, 2 days? Dennis Cimino is his name. And so, yeah, he's got a lot of interesting stuff to share. So I'm sure he'll be all over the map that day talking about everything under the sun. Anyway, that seems like probably a good place to stop the discussion there. I'll pick up, you know, on Wednesday with that. It just gets more and more interesting as we go along. We're going to see a continually repeating pattern, guys, where, you know, they make friends with one king 1 minute, and the next minute they're enemies with that king because he's charging them taxes or whatever. The king isn't kissing their ass, doing what they want, so that they turn to another foreign king and sick that king on him and fund that king. And the next thing you know, that king becomes their enemy because now he's also charging tax. And so they sick. Guys, I guarantee you, this is the reason why we had so many world empires. We went from, you know, the Egyptians to the Assyrians, to the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans. They funded and brought into power all of these people as a means to take out the previous empire. They funded them in the first place, not only to take out the previous empire, but originally, you know, they were hoping to use the first one that they created to set up world empire for them. It didn't work, so they took another one, used another one to take that one out, hoping that they could use them to set up empire. And, oh my God, man, our history has been so completely freaked up because of these bastards. Break up. All right, guys, have a great weekend. We'll see you Wednesday. Take care.
Renegade Broadcasting has a sister site where you can find insightful articles from the past and present, the latest in health and wellness, research, analysis of current events, profound poetry, amazing artwork, lots of videos and podcasts from other content creators, and so much more. We are in a struggle to awaken as many people as possible, put an end to our enslavement in this toxic culture, and create a future where we can be happy, healthy, and free. Go to RenegadeTribune.com, browse the great content, and do consider joining the crew in publishing your own original work. Raptor!